The Gambling Files podcast presents Desert Island Discs with your host, John Bruford. Hello and welcome to Desert Island Discs, the gambling industry podcast with a slight difference. This is where we invite the movers and shakers and occasionally the scum of the industry to come on and talk about essentially about themselves, about their lives, about what interests them, about what floats their boat. Just a little recap, they will be choosing three albums, three books, three movies, one song, not on the albums, one pet from any point in their lives, one object, one dessert, crucially, and two pieces of advice. One from their older self to their younger self, and one from their younger self to their older self. And they can also specify at what point in their lives they give or receive the advice. On today's episode, we are joined by the magnificently titled Professor Dr. Brett Abarbanel of the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Professor Doctor, welcome.
Thank you, John. It's lovely to be here.
What's your department at UNLV?
So here at UNLV, I have multiple homes. My primary role is running the International Gaming Institute, which is an institute dedicated to the research, education, and innovation within the field of gambling and risk-taking. And that's everything from problem gambling and addiction. We have a project it's been running for about 19 years now, so I'm already prepping for our 20th anniversary party next year, to gambling game development, socioeconomic impact studies, operations analysis, different education programs and things like regulation and other subjects. We just love the subject of gambling and risk-taking and do a whole lot of work in it. And then my other hat, the one that gives me the professor title, is my professorship. I'm a faculty member in the department or the College of Hospitality here at UNLV, and my department is Resorts, Gaming, and Golf, which I actually have in my email signature and which regularly fools people into thinking I'm good at golf, which I am not.
Okay. Says me right for asking. Yeah. So I'm going to start by calling you Brett, and then I might just work my way down your name. So
yeah, sure.
By the end, I might be calling you Nell.
Yeah, okay. Oh, that's a nice nickname, actually.
It's
no
not
one's
bad,
ever called me that.
It's not bad. I once had a girlfriend called Davina, and when we first met, I mean, she was just fabulous, absolutely wonderful. And when we first met, I'm like, whoa, Davina. Everybody must call you Dave. And she's like, no, nobody's ever called me Dave. And I called her Dave the entire time we were together, which was, you know, a good year and a half or so.
That's a good nickname. I thought you were going to tell me you moved down her name as well, and by the end you were just calling her Ah.
Yeah, or Nah.
Nah.
Yeah.
Nah.
No. But also all of my friends called her Dave as well.
I can't believe this didn't work out, John.
Yeah, I think there might be a lesson for me in there somewhere. I'm just not sure what it is. I did see her a few years ago, and she is still extremely beautiful, and way out of my league.
Oh, that's the way, isn't it? I'm very happily married to someone way out of my league.
I think it's the way to go. I think aim high. I think if there's a lesson from this conversation, aim high.
Yeah, surely.
Although from where I am, everywhere is pretty high.
Did you say you're in like the flats of Wales? Your sea level?
Have you ever been to Wales?
I have, actually. It's just taking the aim high a bit literally there.
There's not much that's flat here, really, is there? It's pretty hilly.
Pretty kind of shaggy.
Anyway, Professor Dr. Brett Abarbanel, we're going to go straight into, we're going to start with three albums. So lay your first one on us, please.
Okay. So, wait, can I ask you a question first? Is that all right? Can we?
Yeah, you can ask.
So, where is my desert island?
Where?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I assume it's on Earth, but is it a particular area? Or is this sort of like a, just amongst your dreams, Brett?
It's, no, it's about 500 miles west of Guam.
West of Guam?
Yeah.
Would that, forgive my geographical ignorance, wouldn't that put it either close to or on a mainland somewhere?
No, it wouldn't put it on.
Not quite? Okay.
Then did I say 500 miles? I meant 300.
Oh, excellent. Okay. So that's like a quite a lovely...
And it's a little bit south as well. But yeah, the weather should be pretty good. Basically, all your basic needs are taken care of. This island has pre-trained monkey butlers. It has, you know, there is shelter. There is fresh water. Mm-hmm. You don't have to worry about food. You do have to worry about desserts, but that's slightly different.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
So we are just focusing on the luxuries here. I mean, trust the fucking academic to come to this and go, where is this island?
Well, this affects... my choice of item later, and I just wanted to be prepared for the discussion. Yeah, and
does it affect your choice of album?
No, I could have waited to ask the question. This way, I can be in the proper mindset for the entirety of our discussion.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
And I am, so thank you for the preparation. I'm ready to go.
Yeah, okay. So it is a tropical island. It is not a desert island.
Okay.
And in case any lawyers from the BBC are listening, tropical island, that's key.
Okay. This does change things. I mean, that's a lot of humidity, and I live in the desert, so this will be an adjustment. So I really need to enjoy my
album. It's not going to be easy.
So stranded, I guess. So my first album, now that I'll actually answer your question, is the Beastie Boys' License to Ill.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So this album was one of the most key in my teenage years, especially. Still very much listen to it to today. I believe it came out the year I was born, you know, because we're supposed to talk about how old we are, aren't we?
Supposed to make me feel old.
Supposed to make, well, I think it didn't come out in 1985. That was the year I was born.
So 84, 85, yeah.
Yeah, something like that. But it's got, first of all, it has so many hits. I couldn't decide exactly which one to pick because, of course, each one after had some excellent options. But this is, She's Crafty, it's got Girls, it's got No Sleep Till Brooklyn, Brass Monkey, and you got to fight for your right to party. And I'm hoping that if I sing, it won't cause you any licensing issues because my voice is quite terrible. So I can't imagine that an automated sensor would pick up on me singing.
I'm going to try and insert clips here and there where I can.
Oh, excellent. Yeah.
With, you know, reference to the respective copyright holders.
Yeah.
But it's a really interesting choice of album because I totally get doing the Beastie Boys, but I do, I think like if you were my age, that album would be like, I totally get it because it was huge and it was a cultural milestone in so many ways. But like if you were coming on as a Beastie Boys fan, you know, I would have assumed you'd go Paul's Boutique.
Well, I almost went with Paul's Boutique, but if we're going to pick things that were really formative for who we are. And that's the theme I went with here. And License to Ill really was that formative thing. I mean, I remember listening to this. I must have been 11 or 12 when I first listened to this album, which of course makes the album at that point 11 or 12 years old. And and it just, I loved it. It was weird and good. And somehow, despite being weird and good, it was still heavily popular. I mean, these guys toured with Madonna. This was...
Yeah, they were absolutely massive. The British press were up in arms about them.
Oh yeah, how so?
They were just like, oh my God, you know, ban this filth kind of thing. They were just like, and yeah. The Beastie Boys touring, they were like, fuck this, you know, arrest them at the airport. It was really bizarre.
Wow.
It was very, very strange. But now, of course, now that we've all grown up with the Beastie Boys and we now know their sense of humor
and
how playful they are, like the album's just really, really funny and really fun.
Yeah.
But back then, the British press took it super seriously.
Oh, wow.
I mean, who introduced you to it?
It was my friend, Aliza Grant. She is still my friend to this day. And if you keep that section in the podcast, I will send this to her so she can hear me sing her praises. But she always, so she had the older sister. I was the oldest of my siblings, but Aliza had an older sibling. And her older sibling introduced us to the Beastie Boys. And that was it. We were hooked. Completely.
Fabulous.
Yeah. Listen to it all the time.
It's a great choice of album. Weirdly, for the Beastie Boys, my and I know this is probably a real cop-out, but my favorite Beastie Boys is actually Sounds of Science, the anthology.
Mm. You said cop-outs were okay. I do have one or two coming later, so.
No, that's yeah. absolutely fine. But, you know, when you relate an album to one particular period in your life, mm-hmm. World Cup, France 98, I was working in a publishing company in Exeter. It was a beautiful summer. And we had that and Fatboy Slim and Dr. Dre.
Oh, yeah.
Air.
It was a great
on rotation all summer in an open plan office. That's fucking great.
That's a pretty good place to be.
It wasn't bad, I think. I'm pretty sure if the company hadn't gone bust, we'd all still be there.
Well, everyone had good taste in music, to be sure.
Yeah, it's weird that in a big open plan office, you get that many people agreeing on four or five albums.
That's a great point. I mean, that really is difficult to do.
Well, and the Beastie Boys were a big part of that.
Excellent workplace. Yeah, I mean, they really were, and then they continued to be. I mean, for at least, I'm going to say 15 years, but obviously it's been much more than that. But I remember for a solid 15 years, it was just hit album after hit album, and that's really quite
solid
impressive
gold.
For, you know, a bunch of nerds from Brooklyn.
Bunch of nerds.
I think that's how they've described themselves. I want to make sure I'm clear for anybody who thinks that's
Do you ever
insult.
Describe yourself as a nerd, being an academic?
I feel like that would be a bit on the nose.
Okay.
I have never considered myself cool. Is that acceptable?
Never.
No, I don't think so. Yeah. So, you at least must know the name Richard Schutz.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, yeah. So I don't remember exactly when this was. This was at least 12 years ago now, probably closer to 15. But I went on a long spiel about esports and video games, which is the main area that I study and have for the last 15 years or so. And at the end of it, it was like a big ta-da kind of moment. And Richard says, wow, you really are a huge nerd. It was just the end of the statement. There was no more that followed from that. Just a full, you know, there you go.
Good,
so
good old Richard. He does make me laugh. But also, obviously, that's not true. What's your second album?
So hemmed and hawed over this one, too. It was really hard to pick just one. And I didn't go anthology. I picked specific album of AC/DC Back in Black.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because this has, right? There had to be, like, my threshold for this one was essentially which one has the most number of songs I listen to all the time. So Hell's Bells, Shoot to Thrill, Back in Black, You Shook Me All Night Long, which I first heard when I was 13 and loved it. I don't think I understood at 13 exactly what it meant, but that's okay.
Probably about an earthquake.
Rock and Rolling Nose Pollution. I mean, this is the same time where I heard The Jack and definitely didn't understand what that meant until later in life. But yeah, I mean, there are a lot of options here, and I went with Back in Black.
I have a theory about Back in Black, right?
Yeah, what is it?
It's And it's not really a theory, because I'm pretty sure you're going to agree. It's a blues album.
Yeah, you know, I could see that.
Thematically,
yeah.
Lyrically, musically, you just slow it down, it's a blues record.
Yeah. It's a good way of putting it. I kind of wonder if they would agree. So one of my favorite quotes of all time, I think it was Angus. Someone had written that AC/DC has 10 hit songs and they all sound the same. And there's this reporter who mentioned this to Angus and goes, "What are you talking about? We have 12 hit songs that all sound the same."
Well, they found a niche, and Bon Scott died, they refined it perfectly. I mean, Back in Black's an extraordinary record.
It's fantastic. I mean, they've been brilliant for so long. I mean, in what we do, there's certain things we have to do all the time, right? There's certain events that are really important to attend, and one of those events, certainly for somebody who works in gaming in Las Vegas, you have to attend G2E, and I skipped half of G2E in, I think it was 2012, to go to the AC/DC Stadium Tour, and it was absolutely worth it.
I saw them.
I went to Dodger Stadium. It was so good.
I saw them at the Monsters of Rock concert in about 1990.
Mm-hmm.
And that would have been just after The Razor's Edge was released.
Mm.
Which, let's face it, it's not a great album. But it did mean that I was one of the first people to hear Thunderstruck live.
Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah.
That was pretty cool. And that was really interesting because Thunderstruck, it's a decent song. But live?
Oh.
Oh.
That intro must be killer live. I mean, gosh.
It's proper goosebumps. But also Back in Black. So Back in Black is still... Yeah. One of the biggest selling albums ever.
Is it really?
It's sold over 25 million copies, and there are very few records that have done that.
They're finishing up another tour this year. I mean, I can only imagine that this is only boosting that tremendously. That's incredible. Good for them. I remember at that same, at Dodger Stadium, what really stood out to me was not the band. I mean, they were like, this was 13 years ago. They're still in great shape. They were in much better shape then. But that was my first exposure to generational love of music, I think, at least sort of witnessing it outside of my own home, because there were so many people there that had brought their kids. And so I sat in front of a guy who'd brought his two kids. One was probably about 13. The other was maybe 7-ish. I'm not good at estimating children's ages. I could have these way wrong. But the little one, I mean, we'd gotten through, probably 75% of the set, something like that. And the little one goes, "When are they going to play Highway to Hell?" And I was like, this is awesome. You know, that's so great. And I think I had looked it up and I knew it was going to be in the encore. And there was a point where the kids were falling asleep. I mean, this right, it's... Kids only stay up so late when they're about that age, and they had decided to leave, and it was like shortly after that the song came on, and I was like, oh, these kids must be hearing it. There's no way they've already gotten to their car and are driving away, so surely this kid got to hear the song that he wanted to hear.
I hope so. I hope it's not a bitter memory for him.
Oh, I hope not.
But it's a hell of a choice of record, and a landmark. Well, you've picked two landmark albums so far.
Yeah, so we could go downhill from here.
Yeah, I think we probably will.
Yeah.
So, also, Back in Black, again, it's one that came out way before you were born. I mean, what was it, 1980, 81?
Back in Black, 79 even?
No.
No, not that early? Okay, 81. We'll go with 81. That sounds right.
I've got to look it up now.
I'm not good at a few things. Remembering years of albums, estimating children's ages. I'm really bad at assessing people's heights also. That's definitely not a skill of mine.
25th of July, 1980.
Oh, look at that. We'll split the difference and here we are.
So way before you were born.
Yeah.
How did you come onto that? Was it the older sister again?
No, actually, this one, I don't remember if my parents had some of the AC/DC albums, or if it was just another one that I fell into because friends were playing it, or could have just been playing on the radio and I heard it, thought, oh, what's that? I don't remember the genesis of my love of AC/DC, but they are my favorite band. And I feel like it's all, they've always been around in my life to listen to, and lifts my mood whenever I listen. It doesn't really matter.
Sad,
the song.
Very sad day when Malcolm died as well.
Very sad.
But yeah, it's generally recognized that he was the man behind that incredible driving sound.
Oh, absolutely.
If you've never worked out to AC/DC, frankly, you've never worked out.
I think that is a very fair statement.
Yeah, they add something. Okay, what's your third album?
Also before I was born.
It's okay, most of the good music was.
Yes, that's also fair. Creedence Clearwater Revival's Green River.
Holy crap.
Yeah. I'm not sure if it's a good thing or a bad thing that you've looked at me with surprise with each thing I've mentioned.
Everybody that's been on this podcast has surprised me at some point.
Yeah.
But not usually three times in a row.
Oh. May I ask? Because now I'm genuinely curious. May I ask what you expected? what did you think I'd pick?
Well, that's the thing. You can never really know, can you?
Yeah. I think that's fair. Yeah.
But you know, I wouldn't have expected things from you know, before you were born. Not all three of them. So I mean, I'm looking forward to the movies. Okay, Creedence, you know, classic sound. But again, a driving guitar sound. The rhythm guitar in Creedence is generally, it's quite distinctive. And old John Fogerty's vocals, really quite, again, very distinctive sound.
Yeah.
How'd you come to this?
This one was my dad. When I was 14, I don't really think I was a surly teenager, but I think that's the point where I was turning, or my dad really realized I was a lot like him, maybe earlier. I'm a lot like my father, let me just be very clear here. And my dad was really a very engaged parent, and he wanted to learn more about my interests. He, you know, didn't really have the internet. I mean, we had it fairly early on, but he wasn't, you know, Googling what do 14-year-old girls like. For one, you know, the police probably would show up at our house. And for two, he could just ask me. What he suggested was I pick an album that I really liked, and he would pick an album that he really liked, and we would trade, and I would get introduced to the music that he loved, and he would get introduced to the music that I loved at age 14.
Cool.
So I gave him the Red Hot Chili Peppers Californication, which had just come out that year. And he gave me CCR. And I absolutely loved it. And I listened to it all the time. And I started listening to other things from that era. And my dad was so thrilled that I was loving all the music that he loved. And,
oh, he definitely got the shitty end of that stick.
Yeah, he kind of did. But that's what, you know, one of these albums is on the list, right? but he... we would sing along, we would listen to it in the car, we'd listen to it at home. When I hear Green River and Bad Moon Rising, every time I sing along, and if I'm in the car, I'll sing very loudly by myself. And when I listen to Lodi, that one admittedly makes me cry pretty hard. It just really reminds me of my dad. Not even necessarily for the lyrics, just that one in particular. I'm not sure why. Maybe it's just the melody is a little bit slower and more serious. And yeah, it makes me think of him. So yeah, if you ever want to really jostle me, I guess you could play Lodi around me. But
yeah, I just
generally,
have that on my phone. When I meet you, I'd just be like, oh, hi, nice to meet you.
But generally, though, I will say memories of my father are extremely positive, and it would be a short-lived jolt.
Be a happy jolt.
Yeah, happy Joel. Yeah, I miss him.
Eventually.
He was a wonderful human.
That's good. I love people telling me positive dad stories because I don't have any.
Yeah, no, I'm really sorry to hear that. I was so lucky to grow up in a family with insanely supportive parents, and just genuinely, I have one sister, and she is so wonderful. I mean, this is like, so she's younger than I am, and sometimes I joke that I was like the beta test, and then they got it right the second time around. She is hilarious. She's so quick-witted. She's crazy smart. And very luckily, she's my best friend. So here we are.
Yeah, I hate her already.
I know, right? It's kind of not fair when people are like that. And to be fair, she didn't inspire, I think, any of these choices, weirdly enough. But I think she might choose a couple of them.
Interesting. Maybe we'll have her on. Maybe I'll run out of guests.
Yeah. We heard that you're better than the first iteration. Can we do this again?
We'll do a sibling special. Okay, so we got you three albums. Okay. It's got me wondering what's going to be next. I think we're going to three books now. What's your first book, Brett?
My first book is William Goldman's The Princess Bride.
Well, okay. Interesting. Mm-hmm. Now, most people are familiar with the film, mm-hmm. which came out the year you were born, if I remember correctly. Oh, no, it might have been a couple of years later. It might have been 87.
Yeah, it might have been a couple of years later.
But the book was around for a long time before the film. And the book is very different to the film.
I mean, they're both very funny.
They are, but I think the book has... So I've read quite a lot of William Goldman.
Yeah.
And when he wants to be, he can be an absolutely miserable ball sack of a human being. And I
want to know what you were thinking about saying before you went on ball sack of a human being.
Yeah, that's the tone down, listener-friendly version of what I was going to say. The thing is, I love the Princess Bride film. It's a really, I mean, who doesn't?
Yeah.
If you don't love the Princess Bride, I'm not sure you're alive.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
And the book has all of the elements of the film in it, but the film is like a refinement of those elements. It's a perfection of those elements. And the book, it has lots of meandering passages. It has lots of self-referential stuff. And I read it to my kids.
Yeah.
And it was a real slog to read.
I can imagine reading it out loud to others would be a real slog. It's not a direct storyline. And I
only did that so that we could then watch the movie.
Were you worried they'd miss out on some of the important bits in the movie if you didn't read the book first?
No, that's just kind of the way that we've been doing stuff. So a couple of months ago, we started reading The Outsiders.
Oh, yeah.
And then we watched The Outsiders movie a couple of weeks ago. And it's really good for them to look at and assess these things and understand how things become adapted, why they're different.
Oh, I like that. Yeah, that's a good idea.
You learn quite a lot about storytelling from seeing adaptations.
Mm-hmm.
Why The Princess Bride, Brett? This isn't about my kids. Stop talking about it.
I just really enjoyed the book. From the moment I read it, I thought it was funny. I enjoyed the asides. There's a lot of asides. And that's sort of, if I'm honest, and this is not a compliment to myself, that's sort of how I do storytelling. I'm not the most amazing storyteller. When I give talks, I have to write them and practice them so that I don't go off on really long, terrible tangents. Because if you just leave me to my own, the thought process, and this is learned behavior. My mother does this. I've seen my sister do this. My mother's siblings do this. But it's your thought process is, if I were hearing the story, I would want to know all the pertinent information. And pertinent information, of course, is an interpretive thing. So all the different asides come in. And so reading a book like The Princess Bride was great because that's how I think and that's how I do storytelling. So to read a book that did that and was very funny and was a very fun tale in general, and then have a movie to be able to watch as well, I mean, it's like the complete package. How could I not pick The Princess Bride?
That's a great and very complete answer.
Yeah. I only went off on one or two tangents, too. That was actually not bad.
How did you encounter The Princess Bride?
I think there was a copy on a bookshelf in our house, and I would just read books that I would find in our house, and that was one of them, and then there it was. I wish there were a more exciting story, but reality is, like I said, I was so lucky in how I grew up, just one, the support, but also just fostering essentially self-education from two very smart people. My parents are extremely intelligent human beings. It helped make me who I am.
My kids are surrounded by books. They see me reading all the time. They couldn't give two fucks. I don't know. I'm thinking about introducing reading as punishment, and yet they love me reading to them.
Yeah.
They are
that's good, at least.
13, 10, and 8, and they still want me to read to them every night.
I think that's wonderful. Think about your average 13-year-old. How wonderful is it that your 13-year-old is saying, I want you to read to me. I want to spend time with you. That's awesome.
I think that they're just saying, I want you to bore us to sleep.
Just record Dad, yourself, give them some headphones. Do you think Calm might hire you to do one of those
sleep breathing things? I've been petitioning a friend of mine. She's a daughter of a quite a niche horror author and he died a couple of years ago. And man, this guy was incredibly prolific. And I message her every few days to say, I could record audiobooks for you. I'll do it for free. She's probably thinking, she's going to fuck it. It's supposed to be scaring the readers, not send them to sleep.
Free might be too expensive.
Yeah, you're right. I should pay
her. In some cases, it is, yeah.
It is niche. But he was a terrifically fun writer, and I just think it would be a lot of fun to do. What's your second book, Brett?
My second book is my first slight cop-out. It is The Complete Sherlock Holmes from Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
That's not a cop-out, because most of the Holmes books are really short.
Yeah, and it is a book called The Complete Sherlock Holmes.
No, it's...
I checked on my bookshelf, and it's a single book, so I thought, yeah, this will be good.
It is a good choice.
Yeah.
Because there's loads of stories in there.
Yeah.
Like I say, most of those, and it's like, I don't know if you're familiar with Biggles or any of those sort of characters, but a lot of books that were written around, anything up to about the 1910s, frequently the books were very, very short.
Yeah. Well, they published them in pieces, right? Often in the news. And so
I was coming to serialized next. Oh. That's okay.
Erase what I just said.
But Dickens was the most famous. Dickens was the most famous serializer.
Yep.
And as you say, often serialized in newspapers, etc. And you know, people really, really waited for these things. And I was talking to somebody on a podcast recently, and they chose The Green Mile, and of course Stephen King serialized that because he wanted to give that a go. And you know, I mean, he's a big fan of Dickens, as most writers are. And yeah, it's I think Complete Sherlock Holmes is a very acceptable choice.
Oh, thank you.
So you're not here to be judged.
But this is an acceptable choice.
However,
having said that.
Yes,
I love Sherlock Holmes. I'm curious now, sort of listening now. I think to all of the ones that have aired so far, Desert Island discs. Now listening to the future ones as well, I'm gonna have to figure out how you respond when you think something is unacceptable. If it's just a quiet okay, or an
now,
extra enthusiastic.
Like, dear God, why would you do that?
Why would you pick that? You wouldn't be so subtle.
You know, but the thing is, when people are talking about these things, it's usually something that they're passionate about or that they have a strong emotional connection with. And that makes it untouchable, pretty much.
Yeah. Do you ever have someone who just picks things just to dick around and see what your response would be?
Not yet.
I mean, that in itself is would contribute to the goal of this podcast, because it would tell you about their personality. And isn't that part of what you're trying to do, right?
It would tell me they must be stopped. But no, nobody's done that yet. I mean, it is only a matter of time. But I'm struggling to think of something where I would honestly go, because I'm pretty enthusiastic about most things.
Oh, that's good.
What's your third book, Brett?
It's a collection. Yeah. But it is, the collection itself is a singular thing, which is the Feynman Lectures on Physics by Richard Feynman.
Okay.
Is that how you respond when something's not acceptable? Have I just learned after asking now?
No, it's just one of those, oh yeah, she's an academic, I forgot.
Oh yeah, that's where it comes from, yeah. So so yes, I was worried when I picked this that it would come across as me trying to be cute, but genuinely, this is what I would pick. I mean, look, Feynman was one of the voices, not just in physics, right? Physics has so many names and famous names, but
legendary.
Feynman is so legendary in the translation of all of this to everyone. He thought, you know, like many scientists feel this way, that science and especially physics is for everyone. And Feynman turned that into practice. These lectures, I have the original books, but they are also now, Caltech has put them online. The lectures themselves in video form are also available, but you said books, so this is just the books. I won't take the videos with me, I guess. But these, you know, to regularly get to learn about this subject, and I mentioned my father's influence and my similarities to him. He was I'll even say somewhat famous physicist, certainly in his own field. And Feynman was his undergraduate advisor. He went to Caltech, my dad, and Feynman was his advisor. And he didn't actually talk about him that much, but he did talk about all the different lessons in these subjects that he loved. And I have been through the books, actually admittedly only once, and really enjoyed them. And if I'm stranded on a desert island that is tropical, not desert, then something I really would enjoy is to continue to pour through these, to continue to educate myself, because this is then foundational knowledge. I'm not just going to sit around and read this. I'm going to read this again and again and again and build on it and build new things. I mean, I don't know if I have a typewriter or even a pen and paper, but if there's sand, I can write in the sand, right? To do new things. I mean, and that's what my dad did, and I always loved that. He would keep, speaking of tangents and asides, he would keep index cards in his chest pocket with a pen. And I mean, we could be out at dinner, we could be at a stoplight, and he'd have an idea, and he'd have to pull out the cards and write it down immediately so he didn't forget it. And continuing to just reinforce foundational knowledge in physics would help me do the exact same thing. And I always loved when he did that. And I would do it on a desert island.
You could write in Blancmange or whatever your desert
is. And it's just, they're really wonderfully done. This is something where I'll admit that part of my reason for picking it is to inspire others to pick up these books or go to the Caltech website and read and or listen to some of these lectures, because they're incredibly informative. They're easily digestible. And yes, I am absolutely saying easily digestible for physics. And he's famous for his instruction. And you see that immediately with his writing and his presentations.
Okay, maybe I'm convinced. Maybe I'll have a look one day.
Yeah. If you want a lighter version, he also talks about physics in his memoirs. One of them, the most famous, is Surely You're Joking, Mr. Feynman. It's not my specific pick for book, although it is excellent, and I do recommend it. That it's his, he talks about a lot of his life story, but physics is interspersed in it as well, and it's a much lighter touch, if that's your preference.
A lighter read is the memoir of a physicist.
Yes,
Good to know.
I didn't think about wording it that way, but genuinely, yes.
Okay, good to know. We're going to move on to movies.
Yeah, this is where my taste goes way downhill, by the way.
It's okay. Somebody's got to pick Grease at some point.
Oh, good. Oh, I didn't pick Grease.
Still time.
There's still time. I can edit these out.
What's your first movie, Brett?
My first movie is Hot Fuzz.
Wow, I was not expecting that.
So my mother's influence now. My mom loves action movies, from the really good to just absolute shit. Like, we'll see, me and my spouse, we'll see a preview for what looks to be a terrible action movie. And I'll be like, write that down, because when your mom comes to visit, we're definitely watching that. And half the time she comes to visit, and she's already seen the terrible action movie. But Hot Fuzz is just, it's got the absurdity, it's got the humor, it's got the dumb action. It's impressively gory for what should be lighthearted film.
Really,
it's, yeah.
I think
I just
the
really
way
enjoy
I might
it.
Describe it, yeah. It could not be more English.
It is pretty also, English,
but while also being really very American.
I think that's fair as well. Yeah,
it's taken American action tropes and put them on a completely British story.
It has, and they're very upfront about it. They mention all the action tropes.
They sit and watch the action movies.
Yeah, they watch them. And then they do all the moves throughout the movie.
And I think the most influential movie in Hot Fuzz, although, man, there's a lot of references to a lot of things in there, but the one I keep coming back to is Point Break.
I was thinking about Bad Boys.
Yeah, I just don't like mentioning Bad Boys because it's fucking terrible.
Oh, that's fair. That's so this isn't recommending that movie. It's recommending, or rather selecting, Hot Fuzz.
Yeah, it's a good movie. It's a very, very funny film.
It is, yeah.
With some absolutely sterling villains in it. I hope I haven't given anything away with the plural there.
No, I don't think so. There's almost always multiple villains, right? People working together in some capacity.
No. I'm just reading a book about the impact of Scream on popular culture.
Oh, yeah?
And it hasn't really gotten to that part yet, and I'm most of the way through it. But it does talk about the use of the two villains in the first movie and how unusual that was.
Oh, really? I didn't think about that.
Well, me neither, and yet I love horror movies.
The solo. Yeah, okay. Well, Dr. No has henchmen, right? Like, he's the villain.
Yeah, it doesn't count, though.
They don't count. Why don't the henchmen count?
Because they're being instructed. They're not acting on their own agency, and I think that's the key.
Well, I mean, they could be. We don't really get a lot of backstory for henchmen often.
We don't, but I have been writing a book about that.
Oh, have you? Oh, I'd like to hear more. Can we talk about that? Is that relevant to Desert Island?
No, it's nothing to do with it. It's called I, Henchman, like I, Claudius, but for a henchman. And it's
I shouldn't laugh. Is this a comedy book, or should I not
yes,
laugh?
Yes, it is.
Oh,
yes,
excellent.
Is.
Okay.
But I need to go back and start it again from scratch. And it's basically, it's about a young bully's friend being headhunted for a vocational school for training henchmen.
You know, that question has definitely come up in my lifetime. How do you become a henchman? What is your career path?
It's a
relevant. And I don't mean
question.
That sarcastically. That's a genuine.
No,
how does
no,
one
no, totally
end up?
Somebody had since I had this idea, which I had the idea nearly 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. Somebody's written the fucking book, haven't they?
Oh, have they really?
But I don't think it's going to be. I'm gonna write it anyway, because
yeah.
Mine is actually the idea is that it's a trilogy.
Oh, like
because
Hot
in the first
part
book,
of a trilogy.
No, this is an actual linear.
An actual trilogy. Okay.
So he goes to hench school first, mm-hmm. realizes he's not a henchman. He's just one of those people who's just very quiet and in the background because he's actually influencing shit.
Yeah.
And he then graduates to become a right-hand man.
Ooh.
but
that's
is in
more,
fact...
That's more acting of your own volition. You're the right-hand man. You take orders, but you have ideological interests.
But he's also the power behind the throne in that instance. And then in the third part of the story, or third book or third part of the book, whichever way it goes, I'm not sure, he will be the supervillain, which is when we learn that supervillainy is actually a HR job.
You know, I can see that as you increase your role, there really is quite a lot of administration that comes along with it.
Yeah. It's going to be about manpower allocation and keeping people from bitching at each other in the office.
Yeah, it's quite brutal. I understand that.
So by the time we get to the third book, the first book's going to be fairly absurd. The second book is going to be very, very dark.
Yeah.
And the third book is going to be, it's kind of going to be like a very low level absurdity.
Yeah. I sent you the DocuSign and it's been sitting there for 5 days.
So I shot him in the face. Hang on, I just need
that
to
could be down. The opening line of part three.
You're not getting a fucking co-author credit on
that. That's fine. You don't need to take it.
You're already famous enough.
Wait, do you think there will be royalties from this book?
I don't think anybody's even going to look at it.
Oh, then I'm okay not having co-authorship.
Yeah. But I'll put you in the special thanks. Which nobody will ever see. Because
which no one else knows reading the book, yeah.
What's your second movie, Brett?
I cheated on this one. You said it was okay to cheat, so I'm cheating a little.
Yeah. Tells us more
I'm
about
just
going to
generically say I'd like the James Bond film with gold in the name, and that way when you show up with three movies, I can snatch them out of your hands and run away to, I don't know, do I have a hut or something? And I then have three movies for the price of one movie, and they're all three movies I enjoy.
Wow.
Yeah.
You enjoyed GoldenEye, you monster.
Yes, I did. Fabulous video game came out of it, too.
That really was good.
Yeah.
I mean, that, again, that's that video game is a seminal video game moment.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And since I'm by myself, I can play Oddjob all the time. Yeah, so I'll get Goldfinger, Man with a Golden Gun, and GoldenEye.
Okay. And yeah, three quite different movies. And Man with the Golden Gun, one of the all-time great villains as well.
Oh, absolutely.
But Pierce Brosnan, I waited years for him to become Bond, and it was just, the movies were so bad.
It was a letdown, eh? Yeah, several of them were. I love GoldenEye. You're welcome to your own opinion. It's great. I love that movie. Love Goldfinger. Love Man with a Golden Gun. These movies, these are... I didn't realize until we started talking how much of the influence of this list is either my mother or my father or both. Yeah, Bond films are absolutely my mother's influence. She loves Bond. We watch them. We used to go... When Bond films came out approximately every other year, was that like the 90s, 80s into the 90s, the early 2000s? It was always around U.S. Thanksgiving, and we would always go.
Okay. Tell your mom from me, and anybody that's listening, this is completely clean.
Yeah, tell my mom.
I watched a really shitty action movie last night.
Yeah,
it was hilariously bad.
Yeah.
It took all of the 80s crap and brought it almost completely up to date. Whilst it, acting as though the 90s, the noughties, and the 10s never happened. It was called Welcome to Sudden Death.
I'm just going to write that down.
And it is really, really piss poor.
Oh, she's going to love it. Yeah. She's really going to love it.
There's even one moment where a child is dangled over a... I think she's 11. 11-year-old child is dangled over a walk off a walkway, and her dad's really struggling to pick her back up. And this guy's built like a brick shit house. And like, you know, I've got a 13-year-old, and yeah, they're heavy, but not so heavy that you can't pull them back up a walkway.
Yeah.
But when you get the shot of
how old was the kid? How big was the kid? Yeah.
Not big at all.
Not big at all.
You know, luckily his kids weren't fat, but. Yeah. Dangling over the walkway, and then you get a shot from below, and it's quite clearly an adult that's dangling over the walkway. It was fucking great.
Oh, she's gonna love it so much. Yeah, no, she all these terrible movies. Like We discovered, actually, this must have been 3 years ago or so, we discovered she had never seen any of the Mission Impossible movies. So we watched all of them in a row. It was fantastic. She even loved, you know, the absurdity of Mission Impossible 2 with all, like, the extra John Woo bits.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That film has not aged well.
Yeah, it really hasn't. But yeah, she loves these. It's wonderful.
No, I love that she loves them.
Yeah.
What's your third film?
She also loves good
film?
Stuff, right? So, fun films. My third film.
Or fifth.
No, third, right.
Okay.
Because you said Bring cheating it. Was okay, so this will be.
Yeah, cheating's fine.
Cheating's fine. My third film is Clue, and I would like, well, every time I watch it, I want the ending to be random, like it was when it was in the
Oh,
theaters.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, now, in terms of ensemble casts, Clue is one of the all-time greats.
Unbelievable.
Who's your standout in that film? Because the standout for me has got to be Tim Curry every time.
He is brilliant. My standout is Madeleine Kahn. I just love her. I love her so much. she's my standout. Like the flames on the side of my face. And maybe it's just that, you know, speaking of as you... Right, when you become the supervillain, you're in HR, right? You do a lot of administration. I do a lot of administration in this job now. And so lots of red tape and things. And that's normal, right? I'm an administrator at a public university. So we have university red tape. We have government red tape, right? There's a government university. And so I regularly feel the flames on the side of my face. And every now and then I'll even attempt her accent and be Madeleine Kahn.
Nice. For anybody not in the know, Clue is kind of it's like the film of the game Cluedo.
Yeah.
Basically. And when it was originally released, it came out with multiple endings and you didn't know which ending you were going to see when you went to watch it. Which is fantastically odd.
And it was a surprise. I mean, I think it was at each theater had the same ending, but if I remember correctly, but they didn't advertise that there would be different endings. So people went and would go talk to their friends and they had seen a different ending to the movie. There was all this humorous confusion going on around it.
I mean, they don't do fun shit like that anymore with films.
No, they
really don't. So like, it's gotta be a success. It's gotta do 100 million in its first weekend.
Yeah.
As opposed to, let's do something that's fun.
Yeah,
everybody else might have fun as well.
Yeah, I have an honorable mention in my movies.
Hang on, Brett. Just before you get to that,
I just
want to throw something in here. Just imagine if when Avengers Endgame came out, a different Avenger died at the end.
At theaters,
I would have gone to watch that 10 times.
There would be riots in the street.
I would be laughing my ass off in the theater.
Yeah.
Sorry, Brett, what's your honorable mention here?
My honorable mention is Doctor Strangelove. I really tried to figure a way to...
If you're gonna bring Doctor Strangelove into this, use the full title.
Doctor Strangelove or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Bomb.
Fabulous. Yeah, it's...
I nearly dropped Hot Fuzz for Doctor Strangelove. And it was, I'm sure there, you know, if anyone decides to listen to Brett Abarbanel's Desert Island Disc, and that's very nice of you. If you're listening right now, thank you, because I need to express gratitude for the time you've now wasted. It's not a waste of the time, but I love that movie. I got to see the stage production when it was on the West End last year and it was so good. The movie's fantastic. Now I'm almost regret. You know, maybe I will switch out, but I can't. It's too tough.
Who
I love all
who
these.
Who was
movies.
In the West End production?
Was it Steve Coogan? Yes, it was Steve Coogan.
Yeah, I can totally picture him doing that.
Yeah,
he's a wonderful impersonator.
Oh, he was fantastic.
But it's like Hot Fuzz. It is a film that stands up very, very well to repeated viewing. It's a very layered film. And it's back when Kubrick was making films and hadn't disappeared up his own arse.
Has he done that?
Kubrick?
Oh, Kubrick. Sorry, I thought you said Coogan. And I was like, what do you mean?
No,
Has
no.
Coogan really done that?
No. I did meet his brother one night in a pub. And it wasn't one of
Kubrick or
those,
Coogan?
oh, I'm Steve Coogan's brother.
No.
I was out with my mate Toby, who's been on the podcast actually, because Fintan didn't believe he existed. And Toby was like, he was a comedian. Well, he is a comedian. He's an actor. He's a writer. He's, you know, he's written the definitive book about the Quatermass experiment, for example. No, Quatermass in the Pit. Well, all of the Quatermass series. Things like that. And we were in this pub in Manchester. And this guy come in and he's like, oh, all right, Toby. And they were chatting away and he introduced me. And the guy went and we went our separate ways sort of thing. And Toby said to me, so that's Steve Coogan's brother. I'm like, oh, fucking hell. Well, he seemed really nice. I said, yeah, he used to be in a band called the Mock Turtles. And the Mock Turtles in the early days of what we call in the UK, Madchester. So like all this, you know, interesting dance music and all this indie music was coming out of Manchester.
Yeah.
In the early days of Madchester, the Mock Turtles were, you know, they did pretty well. They had a really big hit single and they were going to be the next big thing.
Yeah.
And we were musing on it and we realized that at some point Steve Coogan was described as that guy's brother. But now he's Steve Coogan's
brother.
And now
he's Steve Coogan's brother. Oh, funny.
But anyway, sorry. See, there are tangents.
Yeah, I like that.
I'm going to make a little note of Dr. Strangelove here.
Yeah.
It's a great choice, and it's a wonderful movie. So is there any connection with these movies? I mean, you know, the Bond comes from your mum.
Yeah.
But what about the other stuff? I mean, how do you just stumble across a Dr. Strangelove or a Clue or a Hot Fuzz I can get? You're the right age for Hot Fuzz.
Yeah. Is that the only age-relevant thing I've picked so far? I'm looking at my list. I think it might be.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think. Clue might have also been... my parents. I mean, a lot of this stuff, like we did a lot of things as a family unit, and film was one of those. Reading was one of those. So Clue probably came from one of them. That's my best guess.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, we move on.
Okay.
One song that's not on the albums. The example I always give is Eye of the Tiger. Somebody might love Eye of the Tiger, but nobody in their right mind is going to choose a Survivor album. So
I would pick this album, but I picked Back in Black instead. So I pick AC/DC's TNT.
Okay. Is that Brian Johnson or is that Bon Scott?
I believe TNT is Brian Johnson.
Okay.
Now I have to check. Gosh.
No, I'm sure you're right. It's mid-80s, isn't it? Just for some reason when you
no,
hit
TNT's
it.
TNT's 75.
Oh.
It was written by Bon Scott. So no, I'm wrong. Look at that. Yeah, Bon Scott's the lead vocals. Botched that.
No, when you said it, I had the High Voltage album cover in my head.
I have heard Brian Johnson sing it. See?
Yeah, definitely. It's a live
yeah,
staple,
isn't it? Bon Scott vocals. But yeah, it's I love to sing along with it. Cheers me up. It's my go-to karaoke song.
Jesus Christ.
It's such an easy karaoke song for someone with a terrible voice. All I have to do is kind of shout and people sing along with you. So that's always good with a karaoke song and a terrible voice.
Yeah. I've got a karaoke story, but I can't share it on here.
Oh.
Because it ends with terrible, terrible things happening. I have shared it on the other podcast, having vowed I never would, but...
when you say terrible, terrible things, are we talking like war?
No, not on that
scale.
See,
how bad could it be? Yeah.
Well, anybody that's heard my Las Vegas karaoke story will know how bad.
Like face in a gutter?
No, that would have been good.
Oh, that would have been a good
outcome. What happened.
Excellent.
Yeah, it didn't go great. So I can't believe you picked your go-to karaoke song in there. You now get to pick one pet, but any pet from any time in your life. Have you got any quality pets?
This one's easy. This was the only thing that was not difficult on this whole list. And that is my dog, Hazel. She is a German Shepherd. She's annoyingly smart. And I love her to death.
Is she with you now?
She's not. No, I'm at my office. She's at home with my...
No, I mean, I have...
Oh!
And I didn't mean like, say, have you imagined like, her?
Wheel out of the way, and there she is, right behind me.
Yeah, it's just yes. Like, you know...
She's with us now. She is four. She'll hopefully be with us quite a while longer.
Yeah.
She's so smart. She knows all the commands, and she'll do them if she feels like it.
Yeah, I've got a dog that does that. You see the moment where they're thinking, shall I?
Yeah.
Can I really be bothered?
Yeah.
Fucking smart dogs. They're
so smart. And she's stunningly beautiful. I mean, this is like, it's annoying almost to have such a beautiful dog because people will comment on it. You're like, yeah, I know. I wish this dog were like a hideous mutt. And people would leave me alone with my awesome hideous mutt. But instead, she's an awesome, beautiful dog. And I have to talk to other people when we take her out. So.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I can only talk to people for a little while, though, because my dog is a hunt away and he will start barking.
Oh, yes, of course. It's just a little chatter. And Hazel, too, she loves humans. Other dogs she'll tolerate. They're fine. But humans, this is hot shit when
humans are around. It's what it's all
about. She's so stoked.
Yeah, funny how some dogs are people dogs and some dogs are dog dogs.
Yeah.
And some dogs are dipshits, like mine.
And sometimes it overlaps.
Yeah, it's true. So we've got Hazel. What's next, Brett? Oh, one object.
Yeah.
So what is your object of choice?
What would it be if this
was somewhere drier?
So, this was the hardest part for me. So if the last choice, my pet, was the easiest, no questions. This one, I prepped for this, right? I'm an academic. This was homework. I spent a lot of time on my homework to make sure I got it correct, right? At least correct for me. Everything I've listed under object, it has a question mark after it because I'm not sure if that's the right choice for me. I have landed on, and this is boring and practical like I am, sunscreen.
Tropical island. There's plenty of shade.
Well, there's still, you get the UV rays, right? Skin cancer runs in my family, and I want to be careful, so I've selected sunscreen. Other choices that I did not go with include a photo album of my loved ones, which... Ooh,
nobody's chosen that.
Really? That's such a lovely choice. What, does everybody just remember what everyone looks like? What if you start getting Alzheimer's because you've been on this island for so long? Now I kind of regret picking sunscreen, but that's my choice. Other choice included football, so I could juggle while reading my physics books.
Yeah.
And I do. I played all growing up. I tore my real football, the one you play with your feet, not the. I enjoy American football, but football's football. And I played football all growing up. I was actually looking to go to like recruit for a university to play. And I tore my ACL right as recruitment period was starting. So obviously I went elsewhere. But that changed my life, right? I wasn't like some incredibly talented player. I was good enough to be recruited, but not amazing. I played with amazing people. One of my former teammates went on actually to eventually at one point captain the U.S. women's team.
May I ask who that was?
Rachel Bueller. She was fabulous. And just, you know what? I also want to say this. Really incredible human being, like lovely human being. And not everyone who becomes, you know, famed athlete is, but she really is.
And also, she's got the surname Bueller, so it just makes you want to go, Bueller.
Bueller. Yeah. Almost picked that movie. That didn't make the cut.
That would have been a fine choice.
It was a good one.
Wow, that is amazing. That's a real sliding doors moment.
Yeah, it really was. Oh, completely. I'm in this job because I tore my ACL at 17 years old.
Yeah, but it must have been fucking heartbreaking as well.
Yeah, you know, I think there was, honestly, when I was 17, I thought the world was this insane place and there were so many things happening that it was almost just part of the chaos rather than completely being this completely upsetting moment. I was, you know, being recruited by like famed sports schools like MIT. It's not like I was going to, you know, go play at some huge state school. And I ended up going to a different university. I met my husband there. We met at a poker game when I was an undergraduate. So we'll actually have later this year, it'll be 20th anniversary. And I wouldn't have ended up at that school or at that poker game if I had not torn my ACL and played football in university.
Curse you, knees.
I know. I wouldn't have, if I hadn't done that, I probably wouldn't have continued pursuing this space. I wouldn't have ended up in Las Vegas and eventually here. So yeah, this is sort of where I am.
You might have ended up in Las Vegas, but you could have ended up there as an exotic dancer.
Oh, actually, that's a really good point. I assume other trajectory would have been physics, like my father. If that hadn't worked out, I mean, could have certainly ended up here.
All roads lead to Las Vegas. I say all.
Many. I-15 leads to Las Vegas.
Yeah. So we're going with sunscreen for your object.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going with sunscreen.
And we're choosing your dessert now.
Mm-hmm.
It can be anything. We're not limited by shitty little things like refrigeration.
So there's a fridge.
Well, not necessarily, but let's just assume that we've got a magical dessert.
Doesn't matter. My dessert doesn't need to be refrigerated. It's good when it's refrigerated, but it doesn't have to be.
Is it cheese?
Like one fucking huge black and white cookie from pretty much any deli in New York or like the general tri-state area.
How huge are these cookies?
Well, you can buy them. I mean, they can be that big. Is everybody going to watch this with video? Should I actually say what I'm doing right now?
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I can't say for sure.
Yeah, well, let's say, what is this like? So like 5-6 centimeters in diameter, or
that
you can
looks
get
like, a bit like an apple size.
Yeah. Or you can get like a huge one.
Okay.
And then.
And when you say black and white cookie, you mean like an Oreo style cookie?
Oh, John, no, I'm about to introduce you to heaven. Not an Oreo. A black and white cookie is essentially a cakey cookie. It's sort of like, you know how people talk about whether or not Jaffa cakes are biscuits or not?
Yep.
The black and white cookie is fairly cakey, sort of like the Jaffa cake biscuit is cakey.
Okay.
There's no jelly on it, though. So it's a big, cakey, sort of like vanilla-y flavored cookie. And then on top, it's half black, which is chocolate. And sometimes it's really dark. It actually looks black. And sometimes it's just chocolate colored. And then the other half is like a white sugar icing, and the really good ones, the white icing gets real hard and will crack when you chew it. Not like a big crack, but like it will break, as opposed to like your teeth sinking into it. Whereas the black side, the chocolate side, I think the best ones are when your teeth sink into it versus getting the firmer top. So yeah, just like it's half black, half white type of thing. And they're fantastic. They're basically every deli you ever go to in the tri-state area. They're excellent. And if I'm going to say this is part of the dessert as opposed to being an accompaniment to the dessert, but I'd also like a glass of Japanese whiskey.
That's an interesting choice.
Yeah, they
well.
Go together, my cookie and my whiskey.
Any particular Japanese whiskey?
We could go very fancy and say, oh, Lost in Translation says I should get Hibiki, which is an excellent whiskey. I've had it once, and it was fantastic, and it cost a fortune. So it was comped the first time, so I'm never having that again. But there's loads of really good ones. I mean, the thing that I really love about Japanese whiskey is it just tastes, it's very like a fresh, clean whiskey. I enjoy a peaty whiskey, but it's not really my preference. This like fresh, just punch in the face, yummy Japanese whiskey is my preference.
Before I was working in business to business, I worked on consumer magazines for about, fucking hell, I don't know, 13 years, something like that.
Yep.
Lots of different kinds. I did games magazines, I did movie magazines, I did porn, I did women's lifestyle, I did all sorts of shit. And one of the magazines I worked on was Whiskey Magazine.
Ooh.
So whenever
I
go into
bottles of whiskey and things.
Oh, fuck yeah. Oh, you wouldn't believe how much whiskey I got.
Wrong job. Nobody ever sends me bottles of whiskey.
One of the things that I do as a result of that,
yeah.
Whenever I go into a casino, the first thing I do is I look at what whiskey they've got. Because that tells me who their customers are.
Mm.
Or who they believe their customers are. And you can really, really accurately place the exact demographic that they're looking for by the whiskey selection.
That's interesting.
It's a little harder to do these days because certainly from the UK, all of the really good age expression whiskies are exported now, mostly to Asia. And so what we have in the UK is we now have whiskies with fancy names. Instead of an age, it has a fancy name, and it's just it's a little bit fucking annoying. But no, like, whiskey
it's like
is
when
endlessly
you go to the track and you pick the horse you're going to bet on because you love the name.
Yeah, totally. Who
That's
doesn't
fabulous.
Do that? I mean, I just figure that pro gamblers just know better names than I do. one of the really fascinating things about whiskey is that it is almost entirely a product of its environment. Not completely, obviously, but the water and the qualities of the water, the chemical qualities of the water, are absolutely vital in the flavor expressions. Hence, you know, the peaty whiskies tend to be from Islay and places like Islay. And Japanese whiskies have certain characteristics that are unique to them. So that is a very interesting choice. Dessert, cookie, and booze. Okay.
Cookie and booze feels like such a simplification of this brilliant dessert I've chosen. Of all of the things I've chosen, I'm most confident about this dessert.
Okay.
Just things I won't regret choosing.
No, it's nice and simple. And most of the best things in life are nice and simple.
Yeah.
So I can totally get behind your cookie and booze.
Fabulous.
What's your advice? Which way do you want to do the advice? Have you got a preference?
No. Go back in time first, I think. Now, this advice, this can't be like good advice I've received over the years, right? This is something that would genuinely change something I did when younger.
Yeah, or just help you in some way.
Okay.
People have done variations on it'll all be all right.
It's not
and other people
picked.
Have been more specific.
Okay, this is
some
more
people have
specific.
Been very occasion okay. specific.
Okay.
So, but it's up to you.
Yeah. Okay. So, this was the first thing I've picked here relates to my mother. I get made fun of a lot in my family because there's one specific food I don't like, and I think this is very unfair because everybody else in the family has multiple specific foods they don't like. I'm picked on because I don't like bell pepper, capsicum. It's just, I don't like the taste. I don't like it in things I eat. But it shows up all the time because it's a heavy flavor and people like to stick it in things. Screw those people. my mother has a bunch of foods she doesn't like, and some of those foods include, okay, I picked three, Brussels sprouts, spinach, and coconut. So when I was a kid, we wouldn't eat these three things. They just wouldn't be served because mom didn't like them. Why would she cook them? Why would my dad cook them, knowing that mom doesn't like these things, right? I love all three of these things. I would go back in time to say 5-ish years old and say, Brett, you gotta try Brussels sprouts, spinach, and coconut. You will love them. And this way I wouldn't have gone, say, 20 years before trying these foods, discovering I loved them and feeling like I missed out on all this time of not eating, especially coconut and spinach. Admittedly, I don't want to say as I've aged. I don't think 40 is that old. But I don't digest Brussels sprouts as well as I did 15 years ago.
We've all been there, Brett.
But yeah. Oh, it'll just keep happening. I'm well aware. It already is. But these three foods, I love them, and I really didn't eat them until, you know, late teens, early 20s. And I so wish I could go back in time. This is probably the only thing I'd change about my mother's parenting style is to have fed myself these foods when I was younger.
Okay, well, that is certainly a unique piece of advice so far.
Yeah.
This podcast.
But, so I went specific. By the way, I asked, you know, like when I wrote all these things, right? I asked my husband what he thinks of these. You know, do these accurately represent me? And when I got to the piece of advice, I was like, I don't even know what to pick here, right? And I said, you know, his name's Jared. I said, Jared, what would you pick? He goes, oh, buy Bitcoin.
That's terrible.
Isn't that awful? I mean, it's good advice, let's be real. And it would change today, right? It changed me today. I could, you know, retire, right? That was his advice. Again, very practical. Very practical advice.
It's a very male piece of advice.
Yeah, it kind of is, isn't it?
Okay. What about your other piece of advice? Young you to old you.
That, you know, this is advice I take, and I give this advice to others. So I don't know if that's entirely within the theme of the inquiry, if we're going to change. Because if I'm going to give advice to myself now, why wouldn't I just change who I am now? So I might as well pick something that already affects what I do all the time.
Sure.
This is also related to my mother. Again, when I wrote this list, I did not think about how much my parents were showing up in it. But I think this is excellent advice. Everybody should follow this. And that advice is never give up the opportunity to visit the restroom when the opportunity presents itself, because you never know when your next opportunity will be.
That's really fucking good advice.
It's excellent advice. My aunt, my mother's sister, so they're from New York. My mother's sister used to keep, this showed up on Seinfeld too. My aunt actually did this when she was a teenager, pre-Seinfeld, a map of clean restrooms in Manhattan that when she'd give them grades so that she'd know where the closest one was. Yeah. And then the joke showed up on Seinfeld. George wanted to do this. And I was like, hey, this is a great idea.
It is. I mean, it's a disturbingly good idea, but it's the obsessiveness that births such an idea that's...
Yeah. I mean, she still lives in New York. She lives in the suburbs. She does not, to my knowledge, still have a clean bathroom map. But there's apps for that now, so she doesn't really need to go to the extreme.
Yeah.
But I think, there's something about... Okay, I'll make sure I word this the most optimal way, but there's something really joyous, and I do really mean this word, something really joyous about finding yourself a freshly cleaned public toilet, knowing that you're the only ass that's been on that seat since it was last cleaned and sanitized, etc. And I take huge joy in that sort of thing. I'll take a photo of a freshly cleaned toilet and send it to my friend and colleague Khalil Simeon Rose, formerly Philander, who is probably not thrilled that I'm sharing this with everybody. But it's and sometimes I think, you know, he probably wishes I didn't do it, but that's okay. He'll keep getting them. But that, when you get, for, oh, here's a really good one. When you get that in an airport, that is something special.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Okay.
There's a lot of philosophy around toilet usage that is not just relevant to us as human beings, but has come up quite a bit in our gambling field as well, right? So are you familiar with Betty Binion's urinal theory?
I am not.
Oh, fabulous. So you're probably familiar with the urinal theory, but this is essentially the urinal theory just applied to slot machine banks. So when you go to the urinal, do you, oh God, I can't believe I'm going to ask this question. You might actually say yes. Do you pick the urinal that's directly next to somebody already using one?
Of course not.
Of course not, right. People don't pick when, you know, when they sit down at a slot machine bank, if they have the option, they usually don't pick right next to the only person that's there, right? You know, say like a blackjack table, right? You're probably not sitting right next to a stranger. You'll sit, you know, other side of the table. Same concept. So this was Betty Binion's, you know, idea around same concept of urinals, bringing that to our gaming floors.
Genius.
Yeah. And if you think about some of these layouts too, I mean, it's, they're not necessarily inspired by urinals, but it's the same concept, right? Where you see like a tripod slot machine bank where they're all back to back to back. So you can sort of sit in a circle rather than in a row and takes up a little more floor space. But if you're more likely to get three full seats rather than two out of three or one out of three, there you go.
It's obviously a very smart lady.
Yeah.
It is, one of the strangest things in the world, being a bloke, having a pee and somebody coming in and ignoring urinal etiquette.
I mean, this is surely a, I mean, is this a globally universal thing, or is this just certain cultures? Do some people not care?
As far as I'm aware, it's global.
Interesting.
So I mean, what ladies don't necessarily understand is the extent that this actually goes to. So say you have five positions, or in some godless heathen hole, you might have an even number of urinals. But say you've got five positions. The first person goes in and they take the one furthest from the door. The second person will either take the middle or the one on the other end. The next person will take the other one of those.
Yeah.
Then the next people that come in will take the cubicles.
Mm-hmm.
The next person that comes in will use the sink. And only then will somebody use the vacant urinals.
I wasn't expecting the sink. I will admit, I was expecting they'll wait till somebody vacates one of the buffered urinals and then go take that. As opposed
we're dirty
going
animals.
Straight for the sink.
Well, it's cleaner in many ways as well.
I suppose when you go to wash your hands, most people don't like stick their hands on the sink. So if you pee in the sink, it's not like you're rubbing. But what about particles, right? I mean, surely this is unsanitary. You turn the water
on. You would think so, but you're washing your hands anyway, so.
Yes, but like, I mean, but those things get in the air. What if they get on your face?
Thing is, like, I'm not tall enough to use the sink, so I can't do that.
Okay.
I mean, I would have to climb on.
You don't know if somebody used the sink before you. I have to say, using cubicles all the time now feels very sophisticated and civilized. I'm feeling good about this now, my own approach to toilet etiquette.
Well, I'm glad that we've done something positive today.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in sum, never give up the opportunity to use the restroom when provided such an opportunity.
No, it's solid. It's absolutely solid. So thank you very much for that. I do feel like I've learned something today.
Not sure. This is a urinal theory and nothing else.
Yeah, urinal theory and always take a piss when you can.
Yeah, that's really
it's like that. I do that at expos, not the pissing thing, although I do that at expos. You know, G2E or ice, obviously the floor is massive, and it's like if you're passing a restroom, go and fucking use it because you're not going to see it again. But it's the same with food at those things.
Oh, definitely. So, yeah. And look, we talked about men's restroom etiquette. I mean, if you are somebody at one of these conventions who wears essentially not sneakers or non-trainers, right? Even if you're wearing flats or heels or whatever, you absolutely use the restroom whenever it's available because, I mean, you have to allot a number of steps for the day because your body is just so exhausted from marching around in heels all day. Yeah. I finally learned that lesson. So I want to give a huge shout out here. And I don't know if she is the actual originator of this trend, but she's the one who inspired me. And that's Kelly Keene from Now Defy the Odds. Kelly inspired me to wear sneakers. I guess I should say trainers for all conventions. And not just the trainers, but like I went on Amazon and I bought some fabulous cheap Chinese glitter covered trainers that I now wear for.
Nice.
Like they're my convention shoes. I wore them another occasion and my husband said, "What are you doing? You're supposed to be saving these for the conventions."
I see more and more women at conventions, not wearing heels, not wearing anything uncomfortable. And because it used to blow my mind. Just like, why would you do that to yourself? And they're like,
crazy.
Well, you know, we're told to do this, we're told, or whatever. But actually, no, make the choice. Be kind to yourself.
I'm a huge fan of this trend. It improves my mood, right? It's like, this is why you stop to go to the bathroom. So you're not like thinking about that all the time. You can think about all the different things, the meetings that you're having, the talks that you're giving, you're motivated, you're excited. And your feet feel good. Your bladder feels good.
Probably motivated and excited is probably taking it a bit far.
Not for me. I feel motivated and excited, John.
Fuck. Well, you're being motivated and excited for two. Professor Dr. Brett Barbanel, thank you very much for sharing your Desert Island Discs and Choices with us today. It's been an education. Appropriately enough.
Hope so. Thank you. I'm flattered that you think so.